All right, well, setting the stage is February 1st, 2014, and I'm sitting in the lovely living room of Mr. Edward Hawkins up here in Washington, a bit north of Seattle. And we are going to talk for a while about who he is, what he's done, and why everyone should know his name. So, say hello to the imaginary audience.
Imaginary audience. Hello, all. So
let's start with some history, wherever you'd like to begin.
Well, do we want to talk about animation in general, or do we want to talk about Yamato Star Blazers?
Let's start general and then get into the specialty, because I think once we get going on that, there's no turning back.
Well, I grew up in Seattle and around Japanese nationals, found that I found that the it really started with the neighbor's cat.
Neighbor's cats. There's got to be a story there.
Well, one was, they both came from Japan. One was named Kabuki and one was named Shogun. And our cat somehow magically, our female cat magically spawned a pair of each that looked identical, which got us talking. And over at their house, there was knickknacks. There was some anime. They had some Gundam. And I was
little tchotchkes?
Exactly.
Okay.
And I was like, ooh, that's cool. Uh-huh. I'm like, you know, any kid in the 70s, this would have been this would have been about 73 to 74.
So at the time you were probably into cartoons and comic books and American shows, right?
Very American. Uh-huh. Sergeant Fury and Superman and Spider-Man. But this was something different.
Had a different flavor, right?
Very much so. And I was intrigued by it. Through some time, I was shown a few pictures and some, well, MOOCs. He had some MOOCs. Mm-hmm. And he was a bit of a, he lived in Japan and had just come back basically relatively in 6 months. And it's kind of foggy all the time there, but he had some stuff and I watched it, looked at it.
Okay. Let's back up for a second just for the sake of people who had never heard the word MOOC.
MOOC is a combination soft-spined book magazine.
So it's one of those hybrid words that the Japanese create like every 15 seconds, right?
It's one of those, yeah. Okay. So it's, you know, we look at, I suppose it's something to look at. You'd have to actually see. You've got a hard-spined book, and then we in the Western world might look at a MOOC and call it a soft spine or soft cover. The Japanese identify these, or had to identify these, as MOOC, M-O-O-K.
And they're not periodicals. That would be the big difference.
Yeah, they're
it
not.
It borrows the format of a magazine, but it's not
exactly.
It's not distributed like a magazine.
Okay. Usually one-offs, or usually they're usually one-offs for the title. Mm-hmm. It just so happened that he was also part of one of the few members to a video club. You know, back in the early 70s, these are brand new, very brand new things. Mm-hmm. And I got to see a few cartoons. I actually saw Speed Racer and its Maka Go Go Go. I saw it in its original form. And I was like, wow.
But this is early 70s. So how would you see it on video in the early 70s?
Betamax or some kind of... Yeah, it was Betamax.
Okay, so it was put in before the VHS revolution?
Oh, yeah.
Wow.
Oh, yeah. This could have been a little later, like in 74.
Okay.
It wouldn't have been... It wasn't like really early 70s. I think I still have the cards, to tell you the truth. Huh. The video cards. But... And so some of my memory there is... In the timeline, it's just a little... little off, but... It was also around then, in the mid-70s, 74, 75, that I saw some of the Shogun Warriors or some of the Shogun series that was out.
Right. You mean the Mattel toys?
Well, I saw toys, but I'm talking about some video.
Okay.
That could have been a little later. I'm not quite sure when I saw that.
So then you'd be talking about the shows that led to the toys that then became renamed Shogun Warriors in American toy stores.
Yeah.
Those were really fascinating, weren't they?
They were. Well, we have a store here, which perhaps you may want to visit. Well, you've been to Awajimata. I mean, to Books Kinyokuniya, right?
Sure, many times.
There's one of those, but Awajimata is a big store here. Uh-huh. It has not only one of those, but it has it's just a very big grocery store and has a big store with all sorts of cultural things.
That seems to have been a starting point for a lot of fans, the Japanese grocery stores, because inevitably one will have an aisle or an end cap featuring candy, and a lot of candy, especially in the 70s, came packaged with little toys and cards.
And that's also the other thing. I had gone down there as a child or young adult. I have various stories with that. But yes, candy toys. Mm-hmm. There was that as an introduction as well.
And magazines? Like manga magazines?
No, not so much, unfortunately, because the book part that they had there didn't exist so much. They had a kind of a gift shop. It really started off as the grocery store. And then they had kind of a gift shop, a shop upstairs. And they would have, I think they had a little bit of, they had a little tape section. They had some book section. I don't remember so much manga. That came later. But they had the little toys. The grocery store had the candy and the bubble gum with a toy. Mm-hmm. They still do, of course. But it was about then when I was taken to one of these video stores, introduced at a video store, a rental place. And I got a membership to where I could, of course, rent out these beta tapes. Well, we were poor. We didn't really have a machine. So I actually went to another place.
Did you end up renting a machine?
Yeah. And I'm trying to think of where I rented it. So I had to rent the machine and then the tape and watch it, and only had 3 days or 2 days or something.
Right.
But,
and no way to copy it.
No way to copy it, no way to understand it, other than to sit there and absorb it. Uh-huh. That eventually later led me down to wanting to understand the language and pick up on, I started learning TV Japanese, and then I wanted to learn actual Japanese. Uh-huh. So I did some studying. I took courses. I bought these books and wanted to learn and tried to get a handle on some of it.
Mm-hmm. So it's interesting that you sort of followed the same path that someone in Japan would have at the time, where you got one chance to watch something and absorb it and try to make something of it, and then go and find some merchandising from it. Mm-hmm. So other than the language barrier, it seems like you had the same experience as a native who would have watched something on TV.
Could have been. Yeah, okay.
With very few ways of preserving.
My father was very wise. And he had various points of view that he put in phrases. He was a bit of a historian and a model collector, and he built models. Mm. And of course, a lot of the models came from Japan, or the instructions were in Japanese.
Okay. Probably planes and ships, vehicles.
All sorts of stuff.
Okay.
But, you know, I would build models too as a youth. Mm-hmm. And I got one, and I remember specifically, I got one, and I looked at it, and I made a comment that the instructions are in Japanese. Mm-hmm. And he said, yes, but the pictures are in English. And so from that, you know, it was easy to, you know, that was in a mindset. So when I watched the things that I saw, I didn't look at it as trying to translate the language initially, but more, let's look at the image because I can read that.
Yep.
And then got a better understanding and associated the imagery with keywords and bits of the language. Mm-hmm. I guess that's pretty standard for anybody. But
yeah, the visuals are kind of a primer that draw you in, and then as you free associate, you start to pick up some of the meaning of the words, and then you can recognize repeated words, and mm-hmm. after a while, you've kind of got a grip on it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So all of that started to manifest into this interest. Through the mid-70s, there were more of these rental shops. I was a member of four shops at one point. Mm. And they started bringing in weekly dramas, animation, the whole gambit of Japanese television to mm-hmm. appease the very fast-growing Japanese community that was here. And I was really pretty much the only gaijin that would come in, little white kid.
And how old were you at the time?
Well, by then when that was all really hitting, I would have been 14, roughly, 64, 5, 12. I would have been 13 to 15 when all that was really starting.
Okay. Right there in the target.
I was, you know, yeah. absorbed. I used to take the bus everywhere. One of my side hobbies used to be getting on a bus, on a bus line, uh-huh. running it all over town, transferring just to explore. Mm. So busing was easy for me. And of course, way back when, 13-year-old children could get on a bus and not worry about anything, pretty mm-hmm. much. Mm-hmm. And my parents were like, I'm going to go downtown. It's like, okay. And that's, you know, downtown from, not as far from here, but, you know, a good distance. Uh-huh. That's, today I don't think, you know, culturally I don't know if that's too acceptable, but nonetheless.
And your parents are obviously supportive of the hobby?
Somewhat, in the sense that they let me do whatever my interests were. Now, I grew up with kind of a cross culture. My father was Welsh. He comes from an English background. My mother's full-blooded Aztec Mexican. Mm. So there was a lot of Spanish in the house. And my mom had a lot of Spanish friends and Mexican friends, and she wanted me to learn Spanish. Mm-hmm. I don't know if it was a genetic rebellion when you're at that age, but I was like, I'm interested in this, and I wanted to learn Japanese.
Uh-huh. There's only so much room in the brain.
There is. So I didn't really pick up, much to my regret, the Spanish that I should have learned. It was unfortunate. I really have that regret. That's one of the few that I'm realizing now that in my current condition, you know, is really coming to the forefront.
But certainly you were exposed to it quite a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And you must have picked up something.
I could understand it.
Yeah.
I could understand when I was in trouble. So I spent a lot of time with being in the Japanese culture downtown. I still have copies now because things had, I was able to get machines and so forth to make copies. But game shows and variety of anime. And
so you didn't limit yourself to the anime then?
I have, and this is thinned out, I probably have some 1,200 videotapes still in the garage that, and a lot of it's just copies from that time.
Mm.
And from that period between 75 and to 86,
okay.
Roughly, 87. So I'm muddling through the timeline here back and forth, but in even the early 80s, I was actually buying. And I had a friend who worked at Tower Records. Mm-hmm. He was actually the book buyer. And he had connections. One of them was to, I forget his name right now, down at Books in the Pond.
Kevin Seymour,
that's right. And through him, initially, we'd buy tapes. We'd buy actual, of course, the exchange rate was pretty high.
And you're talking about commercial tapes.
Commercial tapes. Yeah. And I still have those, too.
Mm-hmm.
So
and the Japanese VHS market broke open in probably 83, 84.
Yeah.
Okay.
So my memory's a little off there, but we were buying, I remember buying Area 88's, Onyamas. Mm-hmm. That original tape cost me $260 at the time.
Yeah, they weren't priced to sell. Mm-hmm. I think they followed the American format where they were priced only for rental stores to buy, and they would gradually make their money back over repeated rentals and
mm-hmm.
finally break even on it and continue to rent.
Yeah.
But commercial pricing as we know it now really didn't exist at that time.
Mm-hmm. So anyway, backing up into renting. So I rented. I got involved in trying to masticate this language and at least get basic understandings. There were days I was very serious about it and days I was just, you know, phoning it in.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think I could ever have kept a competent conversation, but I was able to have some phrases and be able to make some acknowledgments. The experience actually helped when, and I'm jumping ahead, this would have been in the early 90s, when the subtitling booms were happening in the late 80s.
You mean fan subs?
Fan subs.
Okay.
Which I have a lot of those, too.
Mm-hmm.
Some of those were, at the time, super prized. You know, if you got so-and-so's dub, you were like it. And there was...
Yeah, you didn't have to have a piece of paper or some newsletter from some mm-hmm. fan club. It was all right there in real time on,
mm-hmm.
on the same screen as the picture.
Well, kind of jumping ahead, my friend and I, we got into subbing.
Mm.
And
did you create a little organizational name?
We did. We called ourselves the Anime Triad.
Oh.
Some people took that wrong. Some people called us the Media Mafia because in the region here, we had grown into this elitistness. And that's a word because it came from my mouth.
Uh-huh.
But I will explain how and why that happened in a moment. But we got into titling. We did some great titling. We took existing scripts in some cases and tweaked them. We even wrote a few of our own. We tried to tackle some TV series. I started a project with Yamada 2. I wanted to do the originals, so I did a couple episodes of that.
Mm-hmm.
At one point, I started working for a company, ISA Media, and they were a CD replication. And this would have been early 90s. But they wanted to expand, and I had television experience from high school and college. Not to mention the subtitling, and the owners, who were friends of mine, were impressed with the projects that we'd already done for them at some conventions. Mm-hmm. So we got an office, and I started doing television. One of the things I wanted to do was start to do some titling. And then also, to make the money, we did B-roll for this boom of electronic games. Like Freddy Fish. You familiar with Freddy Fish or any of the
kids? No, I haven't
heard of that. Fun little kids game. If I had it right now, I'd be playing it. It's just addictive. We'd get clients from all over that wanted us to play, that would have me play segments of a game or record games for B-roll. And then, in some cases, I mean, you'd see them on these tech shows. CNN had one, CBS had one. I forget the other cable company that had one. And they would show these clips, you know, of examples of this game.
Mm-hmm.
And in some cases, the host would be pretending to play that sequence, which I always found was humorous.
They'd be playing the footage that you generated.
Exactly. Exactly. So that made us the money while we were trying to make the titles.
Now you say we.
My friend.
You had the word triad. Does that mean there were three of you?
Yeah, we had my friend Lee Thompson, who was the most involved. And then the triad part came because we had another friend, Tom, who wasn't really involved. He was more of a silent partner, and he helped buy things.
Okay. Sort of an investor, then.
Somewhat, yeah. And he was just our friend, and he was just part of the triad. He was, the three of us just hang out.
Mm-hmm. So was the goal to make any profit on this, or was it just pure fun?
Well, initially the goal was to actually do titling professionally, mm-hmm. because in the early 90s, some of the titling was just starting to come out, and companies were just starting to make title.
Right, that's when they graduated from fan subs to actual import companies, like mm-hmm. Central Park Media.
Exactly.
Animeago.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And we wanted to get in on that, either as our own, or be participant with one of these companies. Lee had a bit of a, you know, today we look at internet romance and we don't think anything of it.
Romance, you mean like people meeting online?
People meeting online, you know, any kind of dating.com.
Okay.
You know, put yourself out there, you search, you go meet somebody, maybe you hit miss, but you, mm-hmm. you know, it's a new dating.
What was once called computer dating and then became sort of a virtual version of the personal ads in a newspaper.
Mm-hmm. So today it's a very societal, acceptant way of...
Sure. It's just another meeting place.
Exactly. But back in the early 90s, it was fresh and new. And as you know, when something's fresh and new, a lot of people have knee-jerk reactions to it.
Right.
So, one day, found out that he was talking with this girl back in Minnesota, I think.
Huh.
And literally one day, he just said, he packed up his car, actually his parents' car, he packed up his car, and he drove out there and dissolved our partnership.
Mm.
And he came back, and... I think he married her out there, but came back with his married wife. And we were all like, because this is so new, like, what the heck is... When that hits you for the first time, you're like, you're crazy. So, unfortunately, that changed. And then I had the TV part carrying on, but technology was changing where the companies were actually doing them themselves. I wasn't too much into replication. I was kind of like, well, let's do sales. I wasn't going to do sales. Kind of moved on from that. Did my own web designing, which was part of something else. Did my own web designing before I moved to D.C. and started a government career.
Oh, that's a whole other chapter.
That's a whole other chapter. But that's how I got out of the TV and the titling part of it.
Okay.
So we'll back up again to the things I saw, such as Yamato. I did see Yamato episodes. Mm-hmm. Saw a lot of that. I was able to see movies. I remember the first time that the final movie was available at the Wajimaya. I remember distinctly I had to see it, and they let me see the first few minutes, the whole introduction with the asteroid scene, and
yeah.
I was like, oh. And this was after, you know, a lot that I was reading about it. I just had to see it. And another poignant moment I will say about that before the place expanded. My father and I would go down there every so often because he had some interest. He'd go down there for books because the Japanese are so meticulous about their war books and their technical aspects.
Mm-hmm.
And he'd go down there and he'd take me and he'd get a couple books every so often. We were at the counter, and this would have been maybe 1980. I'm just guessing here. But they had a Sarabe Yamato papercraft notebook. Stack of them. My dad wasn't really familiar with Yamato, of course, in that aspect. He knew the battleship Yamato, because that was something he was knew. But I remember him looking down at that and giggling about a battleship with wings. I remember that distinctly. But I also remember he bought it for me. And it was like $6 or, I don't know, it was really cheap. And I remember going home and putting every damn one of those paper crafts together.
And what year would that have been?
Well, since it's hazy, I'm going to say it was between, it would have been 78 to 80.
Okay.
Because I don't think I was driving yet at that point. He had to have taken me. And that might have been one of the last times we went down together. And then I regretted, to follow that particular timeline, that particular story, I regretted building all of them. I just, because it reminded me of him.
Mm.
After his passing, I would really... So later in the late 90s and in the early zeros, when I was buying an awful lot off Yahoo, Japan, when one of those popped up, which I, only one had ever popped up that I saw, I bit my heart out. It's mint, cherry, have it. And I was like, spend an awful lot to get that. And so right now I have an empty case. And I have a mid-full case. There were my interests. There were my connections. Talked a little bit about the group, the triad. But I can back up some more. We can try also, I'll talk then also on our group in our promotion of animation.